Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men from the middle of the country get together and talk about politics. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
And this week we're going to talk about Mueller and Manafort and socialism and the statute of limitations on being dumb. But before we were warming up before I started recording on it, we had a good conversation going about Paul Manafort's wardrobe.
Yes, we're getting an insight into his spending habits. Yeah, you know, the sense of style that I'm not familiar with. You're not either, Craig. We were talking about this being Midwesterners, but
yes.
You know, I guess you know Rodeo Drive, you know, out in Beverly Hills, whole different ball game out there in terms of what you spend money on.
Two Midwestern guys. I'm going to guess. I'm going to speak for myself, but I'll put words into your mouth too, Brandon, because I'm pretty sure on this. You've never wore a jacket made out of python skin.
I have not.
You've never worn an ostrich jacket, which we were just debating. That's not made out of ostrich hide.
It's like a style. Right.
I saw a picture of that. I thought it was like from The Onion, and they were making fun of him. But I think it.
No, that's
I think
the
that was
actual,
the actual jacket.
That was the actual jacket. Yeah.
This gets down to, and that trial is. Most people even said it's kind of a dry kind of paper trial. This gets to, he had a whole bunch of money that he got from consulting out of the Ukraine. It was all parked at some bank in Cyprus, and he paid for, or allegedly paid for, things directly out of this account.
Out of these offshore accounts.
Yes. I'm going to guess too that when you buy a new set of tires or something, you don't wire money directly out of a foreign bank account.
Yeah,
to pay
not
for
to
that,
do that
service.
You know, special occasions here and there.
Probably but. Not.
No,
but you know, so he's up for tax evasion, money laundering. You know, he bought $1 million worth of suits, which we were just debating. Is that even possible? Apparently, it is. He had like $4 million or something worth of landscaping done to his house.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of bags of mulch. I'm not sure what that would look like. And just a bunch of really kind of off-center financial
special hot tub installed. I mean, so the takeaway is that he liked to spend money. He threw money down and, you know, and obviously it's where did this money come from and the way he paid for these purchases, that's really what's going to come into play.
And the timeline was he was spending all of this money, then he hits, you know, middle of 2016, he runs out of money, and the money that he was getting paid was coming from Russian business and Russian oligarchs, allegedly for consulting on Ukraine. Mm-hmm. He runs out of money, he has all this trouble paying his bills, he has all of these problems, and then suddenly he volunteers for an unpaid position to run Donald Trump's campaign. What I don't understand, too, is you could have made two phone calls, a simple Google search. You could have called anybody. You could have sent Rice Priebus at the RNC and said, hey, can you ask three questions about this Manafort guy? I'm not really sure this dude's on the up and up.
Oh, he has
a
long paper trail.
This whole thing.
Exactly. Advising and consulting for some of the worst dictators in Eastern Europe and Africa. I mean, he is a known quantity. And so, and the question is the access that being on the Trump campaign afforded him. What doors did that open with other gigs, and where did those roads lead? And so, that is really, I think, the open question, and that'll be what the prosecution dives into a court.
And federal prosecutors rarely lose a case because they rarely go to court with a case that they know they can't win.
Correct. I mean, the idea is that they go in with an airtight case, or otherwise they don't bring charges.
Especially a case like this, which is a lot of paper trail.
Right.
So I would be absolutely stunned. Fox News is trying to spin some narrative that, and Newt Gingrich is leading this charge, that, you know, Manafort could be found not guilty and that would be a trigger to in the Mueller investigation or to cut legs out. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I mean, that's completely wishful thinking. But it's also, you have to remember that Paul Manafort is just one facet of the Russian investigation. There's all of these moving pieces, and he's one piece of that. But in the unlikely case that, I mean, none of the charges held against him, I mean, there's still so many other areas that are being investigated.
Absolutely.
It's not. I think that the problem is that Trump's supporters like to oversimplify, this case. It's either collusion or it's not collusion. It's either this or that. It's not. It's much more complex than that.
And I think a couple of things that folks struggle with is part of what the part of the reason why you don't want to name a special prosecutor, why they're not overly used, is the collateral damage they cause. I mean, when they start investigating, Mueller is investigating a specific allegation against Trump, but he's not going to turn a blind eye to crimes he finds along the way.
Exactly.
If you find that Paul Manafort is laundering money or is involved with overseas governments, I mean, that's a natural reaction and a natural charge that happened during this whole
thing. A crime was committed.
A crime has been committed.
And so there's this reaction that, it's unfair because, you know, this wasn't the intent of the investigation. Doesn't matter if there was criminal action involved, you know, there's a responsibility to prosecute that. And that happens all the time in daily life, but somehow we're supposed to think in this context, it's unfair and it's unseemly.
The only thing I know is that from the year and a half Mueller's been doing this, Mueller is by far of all the players in this game. And if you think of them, there's a lot of them that got a lot of dirt and a lot of kind of slime on them and are a little bit sketchy. Mueller is the one that kind of rises above all of that in his professionalism, his approach. And again, if he brought charges against Manafort, if Manafort's in court, my expectation would be they think maybe even by the middle of next week, this trial wraps up. There's this whole theory that Manafort won't flip on Trump. You know, that's why he's in court. The other theory is maybe Mueller just doesn't need him. Maybe he hasn't taken a deal because hasn't been offered one. But however this is going to play out, I think this is going to happen pretty quickly. And Manafort probably is just going to exit stage left as he goes to prison for the next 18 to 50 years. Mueller picks up Rick Gates, who really is the witness he's working with, and just marches down the Trump path.
Yeah, I mean, this is only the first domino to fall. Mueller is shrewd. He's been around a long time. He's not new to all of this. I think that's why, too, that this, it's been so tight-lipped. Yeah. We haven't seen a lot of leaks other than what Mueller wants out there in terms of the indictments and everything. I think that's testament to his ability to keep everything quiet and to really make sure that this case goes well.
So let's get in topic number one is Mueller, Cohn, and the whole Trump show that's happening right now. And we talked about that. I've always warned everybody, we have to be ready as Democrats to accept there is no there, or there's no way to connect the dots from a legal basis from what Mueller found. Right. We may found that all kinds of people did all kinds of dumb things, but there is no crime or there is no ability to connect to a crime or to charge a crime. It seems like in the last weekish or so, I feel that narrative has changed. It's about when this all comes out and the dots are connected for the public in the Mueller report. The real question now is who does anything about it?
Right. There seems to be too much there to overlook. I mean, especially now that Cohen is claiming that Trump knew about that Trump Tower meeting again, which is, you know, directly contradicts what he said before. And the fact that Cohen is a cooperating entity now, which was not the case several months ago. So much has changed. And the question is, what are Republicans in Congress prepared to do? And it gets back to the extent of the charges and extent of what is brought out, I think, whether or not they will. And the timing, too, because, I mean, we're in an election cycle. So how far out from the general election, that's going to have an impact on what the action they decide to take or not take.
So let me ask you, what do you expect them to do? As a Republican, let's just say for sake of argument, Dems narrowly win the House here in November. The Republicans hold the Senate. Mueller's report comes out in November, October, sometime in there. He clearly outlines what he feels is a connection, and the evidence shows is a connection from Trump to Russia to conspiracy to defraud the election process, and recommends impeachment. What are your expectations of what happens at that point?
Well, so we're assuming that the Democrats gain control of the House.
Democrats got control of the House. You've got control of the Senate.
Right. And I think you have to remember the Senate is a very different body from the House.
Yeah.
And there's a number of, I think, moderate Republicans who, based on the election results, will, I think, kind of be a little bit more open. There's also, I think, the next election cycle on the Senate side is more favorable to the Democrats, unlike this cycle.
It is.
So that's going to kind of factor in as well. So you have to look at that. But I, you know, I think you'll have a couple of Republicans, I think, split off. The question is how many, not a significant number, but you'll have a few.
And don't you have to get past 60? You got to get to like 70 something for impeachment, don't you? You got to have 2/3 of the chamber for the Senate.
Right, to actually impeach. Yeah.
So there's no way. There's no way 19 to 20 Republicans are going to vote to impeach Trump. I don't feel, even if there's direct evidence that he committed a crime. I just can't imagine a scenario where that happens.
Yeah, not enough to meet those numbers. Even if it doesn't meet that threshold, even if there's 50, 51, 52, I mean, that's damaging, though. That's a lot of damage to Trump's legislative agenda.
True. Well, his presidency is over after that.
Right.
And let's be completely honest. If the Dems win the House, his presidency for the next 2 years is effectively over because they'll block everything.
Right.
If we win the House, me speaking as a Democrat, I can't picture a single issue we would support the president on. Certainly not border security. We're certainly not going to get into that fight where we look for other ways to maybe even reform the immigration process if the wall was linked to it, which he seems no ability to separate
those two. Yeah,
we've gone as far as taxes as we're gonna go. There's even nothing. To the point now he's talking about doing another capital gains tax cut by executive order. There's just no common ground at this point.
Right. I mean, the only, I think, legislative area that may have potential is some type of infrastructure bill, which he has talked about broadly, but hasn't put any specifics behind, because that seems to be an area where you could see Democrats come together, and if, you know, Trump might be enough to get Republicans on. But again, you know, that it's too far out to even predict that based on what happens with the investigation. But that would be the only area, I think, where Democrats might be willing to do something.
And as a Democrat, I'm not voting for anybody who's going to play nice. It's on. If you got voted in right now as a Democrat and you specifically flipped a seat, you're there to be an obstructionist to the president. That's why it was sent, is to stop the Trump agenda.
It was a message being
sent
in November.
If you turned that into, I'm going to look for ways to work, I don't think that's going to fly.
Right. So you basically, we're going to have gridlock for the next 2 years until 2020, with the message going into the next presidential election saying, hey, you know, this is, we need a full scale change.
I think and isn't in some ways that what both sides want? And I'll put it in this term. We don't want any more of the Trump agenda passing as a Democrat. And as a Republican, you don't want any more Trump damage.
Right.
Maybe the best thing to do is sit for 2 years and let this sort itself out again on the national level.
There's mutual agreement there. Yeah, I think on both sides that like it's kind of stop everything where it is and just wait until we can get to the next election. Now, I mean, that's been the biggest criticism of our government for so long is the dysfunction and the logjam.
Absolutely.
But, again, we're in a whole new arena with the president who, you know, is day by day contributing to that. Yeah. I mean, leading that, really. So it's a little bit different. And I mean, really, Congress has taken a backseat to the president this entire time. And so as a Democrat, if you're coming into that environment, what incentive would you have to work with this guy?
And I'll go into it again. I don't know. What are your expectations of Congress right now? None.
Right.
They have completely disengaged from this process. They don't pass meaningful legislation. They don't join the argument. Especially the House. What would you look for the House to do? The House doesn't really pass anything that could pass the Senate.
No.
So they can't get themselves in. They can get themselves together enough and control the different caucuses to get something through the House that they know has no ability to pass the Senate whatsoever. So coming up with a common piece of legislation that I just think the House is totally incapable of that. And with Mitch McConnell, the Senate is, I think, even worse. The Senate's not even going
to
try.
Well, and the House has taken a series of symbolic votes. I mean, votes just to help their members in the fall.
I think that's the best way to say it.
Plan on the votes passing. So it's basically symbolic votes, prep their members for reelection. And there's no legislative agenda that they are advancing separate from the president.
No.
So, I mean, it's just, you know, the president says, I want this, and then they try to spearhead it through, and it gets blocked in the Senate.
I'm not a fan of Paul Ryan, but I think this gets worse when Ryan leaves.
Yeah.
I mean, Ryan at least had the lifelong need, want, desire to pass tax legislation, tax reform. Now that he's done that and he's gone, what is McCarthy or whoever is going to lead that body next, or Pelosi or whoever? What is their agenda going to be?
Right.
Let's say the Democrats win. To me, the Democrats winning and Nancy Pelosi becoming speaker again, that just guarantees we're all just going to sit here for 2 years and look at each other.
Yeah, and I think that could be really surprising, because more and more, especially new Democratic candidates, are saying that she doesn't have their vote. She can't take their vote for granted. So there seems to be this just growing sense that new leadership is needed. You can't go with the old.
Hope that happens. And what gets me is how strongly Pelosi is trying to hold on to it. I would have thought Pelosi would be one who would start saying, hey, I've been at this a long time. It's probably time for me to let one of these talented new people come along. What I really look forward to is to mentoring them. That's what a person that senior who has accomplished as much as Pelosi has accomplished through her career, isn't that what they're supposed to be saying at this time? Instead, she comes off as this gross, aging person just scrapping to hold on to any shred of power she can.
Yeah, it's not it's not very flattering at all. I mean, part of when you're in service is kind of knowing when your time is up and knowing when it's time to hand on the baton to the next person behind you. And she hasn't been able to do that. And she has an incredible experience, and I mean, number of years where she's been leader, first woman House Speaker. But you know, the last several years, she hasn't been very successful. I mean, she hasn't been able to really kind of rally her members in the ways that you would expect leadership to do, party leadership.
And when people start beating up on me for saying, you know, hey, you know, Pelosi, she's earned every right to be speaker again. What I always ask people is, why is it important that she's the speaker?
Right.
What is so important that she needs to be speaker over pick any number of Democrats that are out there? You could make an argument that it would be important for, I'm going to get her name wrong, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to be Speaker of the House, because it's important to forward the Democratic Socialist agenda, whatever the shit that means. That would be at least an argument that you could say, here's why I feel it's important for her to lead, to show leadership.
Although Ocasio-Cortez is in the other extreme, that she's so green and so fresh that
I
you're
get that,
throwing
but,
her into
but at
a,
least you could say, I believe in this strongly, it's important for her. What does Pelosi champion in some way that people feel it's important for her to grab the gavel again?
Yeah, I mean, she hasn't been effective the last several years. So again, that effectiveness has been lost. And so the only argument for her is that she's been around as long as she has and the experience. And, you know, but the effectiveness argument is out the window.
So for years, as I've gotten older, and it's just dawned on me that I'm like 20 years older than you, Brandon. For years, I was always mad at young people. You know, young people, damn it, they don't know how to do this, they don't know how to do that. Now that I'm getting older, I'm getting more agitated at old people than young people, as in get out of the way.
You don't want to give up the reins.
What more do you want? You've had power for so long. Why can't you've done everything there is to do. Nancy Pelosi is financially set. Her legacy is set. You can make it, you can do whatever you want. I've kind of gotten more agitated at people who they reach a part in life that they've accomplished what they wanted to get done, and they have enough money that they could go do anything they want, that they just sit there and block people on a path to get in front of them.
Well, it's detrimental too, because you don't have new ideas, because you've been in there
new
that
leadership
long.
Coming
yeah,
up.
It's the same ideas. You're accustomed to, you know, the Washington way and, you know, the lifestyle. And there's a lot to be said for bringing in new, fresh people who are willing to try things differently and, you know, go out of the box to accomplish legislation, you know, move forward. And you if you've been in the House or the Senate for that matter for 20 years, I mean, it's just your likelihood of doing that is diminished, and your faculties are diminished. I mean, you're not as quick, you're not as agile.
Absolutely.
You need a lot of assistance. I mean, you can't be as effective, and you see that when you see especially many of these more senior members of the House and Senate attempt to give remarks or to comment on what is happening, and you look at it and you're like, that was incoherent. Like, what was she trying to say? What was he trying to say?
The examples I'll give you is Orrin Hatch. Orrin Hatch, I love Orrin, but when he kept asking Zuckerberg, how does Facebook make money? And he could not.
Oh, that became a meme. That was shared all over.
Zuckerberg's just looking at him saying, we sell ads. And he just could not comprehend his mindset. The other thing that Orrin Hatch, and I think he said this today, which made me just want to just blow my brains out, when he was complaining that Kavanaugh is being treated so unfairly by the Democrats, and he can't remember a time that his party treated a nomination as partisan and as unfair as the Democrats. I literally just wanted to pick my computer up, scream Merrick effing Garland, and just slam it down.
Yeah, there you go. That's politics for you. He's playing the game.
We started this with Trump and Cohn and the investigation. Cohn is really inserting himself into this now. He is going to be taking on much more of a role. He's got much more of this story, I think, to tell. I absolutely believe Cohn if he says, of course Trump knew about that meeting. Well, and here's the five people in the room that were there when he did
heard
it.
And saw everything. And he tape recorded apparently every conversation that went down. So there's so much now at the disposal of Mueller and the team. I mean, and so as they comb through that, it'll be interesting to see, again, how they put these puzzle pieces together. And I think that's also why Trump continues to just self-destruct in terms of what, you know, he's putting on Twitter and saying out there. Because, I mean, that has to be eating at him, the fact that he has Cohen, of all people, who has turned on him.
Yes.
I mean, he can't sleep easy at night with that. I mean, who would?
I've watched a lot of Law & Order, like 20 years of it. And back in the day, I watched a lot of L.A. Law. So one thing I can tell you that your lawyer always tells you, shut up.
Stop talking.
If I'm not in the room, don't say anything. I can't believe Trump, who has been around lawyers his whole life. Trump has basically been involved in a lawsuit or for the last 50, 60 years.
Right.
He's not listening to the advice. He's not taking the advice. I just don't understand when he tweeted out the other day, hey, Sessions, you should shut this down. You need to stop this. Does his lack of awareness that you are in an actively ongoing federal investigation, and that could have some consequences to it.
Right. Well, I mean, he is the most self-unaware person you can probably find, so it doesn't surprise me at all. And he just reacts in the moment, you know, and I think there may be, you know, and I don't want to diagnose or play armchair psychiatrist with the president, but I think there's underlying issues there. You know, you could have pre-dementia, who knows? But I mean, because constant like verbal diarrhea, you know, and reaction in the moment without thinking through anything. I mean, that's his MO. But look back at the attorneys. I mean, how many attorneys has he gone through now? I mean, his legal team has changed over how many times? Because again, he doesn't listen.
He doesn't
listen. Why would you stick around?
And then he also doesn't pay on time. Attorney. If he pays at all, is another one.
And that's a common factor with not only attorneys, but all the contractors throughout his career.
I mean, he story around this president.
Yeah, he does not pay on time, or he tries to underpay, undercut.
So we unplugged the studio last week. I use the word studio very, very, very liberally here. And here comes it over the phone. I think that was when Senate or our House members file for articles of impeachment against Rod Rosenstein.
Right.
And both of us thought, like, oh shit, here we go. This is going to be something serious. That died in about 24 hours when people saw, one, who it was, and you were right, it was the Freedom Caucus guys, Meadows and Jordan.
Yep.
And then they saw how absolutely
nailed it exactly
horrible the documents that they put together. People talked about the number of factual errors that they had in it. They had had dates wrong. They had times wrong. They had agencies wrong. Just what an absolute joke that was. And that didn't even last 24 hours.
Oh, yeah. That was shut down quickly.
It just kind of petered out. And then when Paul Ryan came out and said, yeah, that'll never see the light of day. We're not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, basically those two, I mean, Freedom Caucus members, but also big supporters of the president. So it was a way to ingratiate themselves with Trump for whatever reasons they have down the line. But, you know, that's really all it was. It was, I think, theater, political theater, you know, for his benefit and to ensure that he was aware of that. And that's what you seem to be seeing over and over again, as particular members of Congress playing for Trump and, you know, trying to get his attention and, you know, his good graces that way. That seems to be a commonality. You have a candidate running for governor in Florida who DeSantis.
DeSantis. Yeah. Have you seen his wife, the commercial with his wife?
Oh, yeah. And his daughter. And he's helping her build a wall. Yeah. That commercial, you know, the personality cult element of it is just so creepy. I mean,
I will be hypocritical and take a sponsorship from Florida if they want to sponsor the pod for vacation in Florida. But that if DeSantis wins, everybody in the Midwest needs to cross Florida off the list of ever journeying to that state again.
Do you know how DeSantis got Trump's attention? I mean, he's Trump's endorsed candidate, but it was his numerous appearances on Fox News being Trump's defender. Now, do you think that was all just, you know, happenstance? Of course not. It was intentional.
He hired a political consultant that said, this is how we're going to do
it. It was a plan that was put in place.
There's a guy I follow on Twitter who every day releases President Trump's public schedule, because the president every day puts out to the pool, to the press pool, this is what his schedule
fairly
is.
Fairly common,
It never starts before 11:30. It typically starts at 11:30 with lunch, and he has one briefing or two briefings a day if he's not traveling somewhere. Because again, from 5:30 to 11, he's nonstop Fox News, and he's flipping through everything, and he's consuming news and making that mental note of who is saying what about him and who he needs to attack on Twitter today.
Yeah, it's easy to tie his tweets, you know, directly in terms of the timestamp to what is being said on Fox.
He's a 16-year-old girl.
Directly, yeah.
He is a teenage girl who's sitting there just getting mad and getting revenge on friends who he feels have slighted him, or enemies that have said something against him. And that's how the president of the United States spins to 11:30 every day. That's just,
yeah, we have nothing to compare it to. I mean, it's it's surreal.
It's I've never seen that before. Never.
Yeah, it makes you think. I mean, and I think there's been stories that aides of his have tried to get him to reduce his Twitter time and take it away. It won't happen. It just won't. Yeah.
I've always thought that I had the ability and I could be president of the United States. Trump in some ways just proves that dream for everybody. If Trump can do it, just about any human in the United States could be president, without a doubt.
Right, yeah. I mean, we've survived up until this point, you know, based on where we are, you know. So it's this far into the presidency, 18 months in, 20 months in. So, but it's a good example, too, of the checks and balances kind of built into the system.
We will survive. We'll survive
right.
this.
And so while a lot of it is very, I think, concerning, you know, our system is built to withstand, you know, not only tyrants, but also abuses. And so we've seen that play out. Now, again, there may be a time, you know, in the near future where that's not the case. But again, that's where we have to hold our electeds accountable to act. Because if one of these shoes drops, if Rosenstein was, you know, fired, that would be, that's it.
I think you'd see a whole mechanism snap into place, and that would be, we'll tolerate you to a little bit as President Trump, but we're not going to tolerate that.
Right. I mean, that's basically a breakdown in the Democratic order from that point. You can't tolerate that.
No. So do you think, now that it's come out that Trump is trying to push his attorneys, Giuliani and Seclio and those guys, to set up a meeting with Mueller, and what they're trying to negotiate is, what can be asked verbally and what could they provide in writing, and that he is really pushing them because he feels like, again, the master negotiator that he is, if he can get in front of Mueller, he can somehow spin this tale that makes Mueller throw his hands up and say, well, you are right. This has all been a hoax and a witch hunt. This is over.
Just like his approach with North Korea, with Russia.
Do you think Trump will ever sit down with Mueller?
I don't see it coming to that. Mm-hmm. I think he'll continue to make noise, but I don't see any circumstance where his attorneys would allow him. It. I mean, I just I don't.
I could see maybe where they would do a written statement, but they're not going to let him sit there and go free form with Mueller. There's no way.
No.
The man can't go more than 5 minutes without being incoherent or just telling a blatant lie.
Well, there's so much danger in it for them. I mean, and they see it, and so they can't.
If you're Trump, how do you answer the question? I'm Mueller, you're Trump in this, right, in this scenario. Mr. President, did you tell James Comey to drop the investigation of Michael Flynn?
Well, and then he would just, you know, start stammering and, you know.
Because you had to pause because it's like, well, do I lie?
Right.
Or do I say, yeah, I said that. I mean, you can't.
He's in a, there's no good way that he can answer that, no, based on what we know.
If you're one of the attorneys, you can't let him answer that question live.
No.
You may be able to write an answer, but you can't let him field questions like that.
No. And I mean, and the problem is Mueller and his team are shrewd. They're going to, you know, hit him and hammer him. And, you know, again, in his head, you know, he is a master negotiator and he probably thinks he can just distract and divert and that'll be enough. And that's not how, it's not how this works. It's very different than what he's
accustomed to. And he's convinced he can't be charged with a crime.
Yeah.
And that none of this is going to stick to him and it doesn't matter. So he might just come out like he did with Lester Holt and say, hell yeah, I fired him because he was up my ass about this Russia thing. So the easiest way to get rid of it is I just fired him.
Hence, all the questions and about whether or not he can pardon himself, you know, because
if he pardons Manafort, game on, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. He can't do that.
There's no way. He would wait until after the midterms. Because if he did that, like in October, people would just absolutely melt down at that
point. That's another thing, again, as somebody who's completely unaware or self-unaware, the fact that he keeps commenting on Manafort and saying what a good guy he is and how this is awful, like, you do not do that as this investigation is proceeding.
Is he signaling to him? Is he telling him, hey, don't worry? I don't. You're right. What information he is processing and how he's processing it, there's just no way to know.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling.
So let's get on to we meant to cover this last week, but we went long and got sidetracked. That my side, the Dems, we seem to be really kind of flirting around with this term socialism. We seem to be not quite going all in on it yet, but certainly floating this balloon up and seeing what type of legs it has, if any. In the Kansas 3rd, where Mike's running, one of the guys he's running with was a big Bernie guy.
Right.
And Bernie and Alexandria
Ocasio-Cortez came in to stump for him.
Came to the 3rd.
And Brent Welder,
I read an article the other day that, you know, they are trying socialism out in the heartland. And I guess it kind of feels like to me, is this the Dems' attempt in 2018 at populism? That we're trying to trot out socialism and somehow is that as a combat to what Trump's run out?
I think there's definitely an element to that. You have to remember that, you know, Bernie's supporters are more energized than ever. They feel slighted by what happened still in 2016. And so, you know, the reaction to that has been to push even more.
Yeah.
So you see a number of these Democratic primaries around the country. The question is how they turn out. You know, in some of the districts in the heartland and in the swing areas, do the moderates win out or do, you know, the more pro-Bernie, you know, far-left candidates come out ahead?
Let's start this. Let's start this way. Give me your definition of socialism. And this isn't a trick question. It's because there's so many people twist that term into so many different things. What is your classic definition of socialism?
I would say direct state intervention into many areas of the economy, you know, including key industries and sectors. So you typically have major industries that are nationalized, and run, you know, by the centralized government. So I mean, that's really what it is. It's direct government intervention into massive sectors of the economy.
So I'm gonna play I'll play the democratic socialist hat, although that's a stupid name and a contradiction of terms, and it's dumb.
Right.
I'll try to defend it the best that I can. From the definition that you just gave, I would say, well, we already have socialism. We just have the worst parts of it.
Well,
we have socialism that works for the upper class, the business class, and the ruling class, because the government intervenes in the economy all the time.
Well, that's true.
Impact a small amount of people making a whole bunch of money.
And we do not directly have a pure free market capitalist economy. And in fact, those don't exist really anywhere. So what we actually have is what you would call a mixed economy. We have, you know, elements of free market, aspects along with, more direct state intervention. And so it's a mix. And that's what you tend to have too. In Europe, although you have some European countries that veer more towards the socialized side, the Scandinavian countries tend to be more socialist in terms of just the extent of their involvement in the economy. So it is. It's about extent and variation. But yeah, I mean, what we really have is a mixed economy. We have direct state intervention in many sectors and areas, and then not at all in other areas.
I think socialism, to me, how it's being packaged right now, is being packaged through a lot of free stuff. That's the latest kind of iteration the latest package they're wrapping socialism in. And I think they're wrapping it around basic social right or basic human rights. Everybody should have health care. Everybody should have education. I think that's the wrong way to present this, because that's a great 10-word answer. Brandon, you and your children and your family should all get to go to school free. You should have free health care, and you should have a guaranteed livable income that the state should provide to you. That is a great 10-word answer.
Oh, yeah. It's sound bites. It's rhetoric. But there's no plan behind it. There's no how are you going to pay
for
it.
There's nothing behind it.
How are you going to implement it?
And I get it. Bernie came out and said Medicaid for everybody. They said that would cost $36 trillion. And there's some study that came out that says that that's actually a bargain. But from what other countries have done, there's no way to administer it. Because when you have that much money and you have the central government control of those types of resources, corruption, waste, bureaucracy, eventually it slows down to nothing. So I'm always kind of leery when somebody packages socialism with you get something free,
right,
instead of saying, hey guys, we already have a mixed economy or elements of socialism in our economy. What we're about is making that more fair.
Right.
And I think that would be a much better approach than putting out a 28-year-old bartender. And I'm not saying that I'm not trying to belittle her experience or her age or where she is, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, closest I've ever come to saying that, is in no way has the depth and the ability to have a nuanced conversation, especially in Kansas, about socialism.
No, and I think it's a complete mistake to bring somebody like that here and expect that that's going to translate well, because it just won't. The fact of the matter is, you can make headway by looking at Medicaid. How can we, not Medicaid for all, but expand Medicaid and make changes to it to make it more effective,
sure,
and work for more people? Same with Medicare, which is the most popular, government program out there, and happens to, to be in the healthcare side. So there's a lot you can do in the margins and around the edges to improve and do so. But throwing out, free healthcare for all, free college for all, there's no way. I mean, that's not going to work.
No,
you can't
way.
Put no. It's you can't implement that.
And I think too,
we're already in this cycle of debts and deficits that continue. And I mean, it would explode if you add even one of those big items.
And I think too that it's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a reaction by Democrats because she's young, she's enthusiastic, and she brings energy. And we are so desperate for that that's what they're pushing her up, kind of this national. They're raising her profile because of her ability to connect with the crowd, her ability to deliver enthusiastically a message, not on her policy, not on her platform. And this is also what I've argued with people. A freshman congressman has one vote of subsequence. Who is Speaker of the House? Yep. That's it. After that, you're not introducing any legislation. You're not going to be the face of it. There's a pecking order.
And, right. And you're typically, you're not leading organized. Any committees. You're Absolutely. Not on the prime committees yet Absolutely. At that point to, direct change. I mean, all of the legislation, it all happens at the committee level.
Absolutely.
You know, anything that hits the House floor or the Senate floor, it starts in committee. And so if you're a committee chair, you exert more power because you can pick and choose what comes to the committee.
What you just said, there are specific rules and structure to keep a freshman congressman from coming in and making a huge impact.
Right.
It is amazing what she did in defeating Crowley, and everybody should take notice of that. And that was a remarkable feat. And this woman has a fantastic political future ahead of her.
Absolutely.
But if she's going to crack into true leadership and really try to change things, she's going to have to figure out how to package her presentation of her platform more than 10-word sound bites.
Right, and she has to, if she's going to go speak across the country, she has to package her message in a way that's palatable, to, the Midwest and to the South. I mean, she can't just take that message from New York and think that's going to play across the country.
She ain't
going to
roll down to Mississippi or Detroit right. or that. I would think, too, that before... and Mike and I have talked about this. The allure of power has to be so strong. I would have said, there's no way I'm ready to go national campaigning. I need at least 6 weeks.
That seems way too soon. She just won a primary. Absolutely. I've never heard of somebody being sent out for national.
Bernie, give me your political consultancy machine. And what you just said, let them beat me up for 6 weeks.
Right.
I need to put some battle scars on me so that when I go out and sit with an interview and suddenly they bring up Israel and Palestine, I can at least regurgitate something that shows some awareness of the topic.
And I think her approach will change too once she is in Congress and she sees how the sausage is made and just has familiarity with the process, because it's easy to go out there and just throw
yeah.
these ideas out there and expect that they're going to happen tomorrow when they're not. I mean, you got to be realistic.
Well, what's the old phrase? Nobody ever changes Washington. Washington changes you.
Right.
That we'll see.
And you're one of 435 happens. In the House in Washington. So if you're
the lowest level of that 435.
And if you're going to enact change and impact change, you have to be willing to work with others
Absolutely.
And compromise, which
Absolutely.
Is a dirty word, and bring people together. And so it's easy as a candidate to throw everything out there. It's very different governing, and I think the difference between campaigning and governing is very stark.
And that's, you saw this in Obama, who for some reason won a Nobel Peace Prize his first year as presidency, when he was bombing the shit out of everybody.
So premature. It was based on what they thought he
Absolutely.
Was going to accomplish.
And he got in there, ridiculous. Saw the daily intelligence reports and thought, wow, I don't want to do this, but I think we kind of have to.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see somebody like, I'm just going to call her AOC from now on. When she gets in there, she'll get sucked into the herd and you'll probably never see her again.
That's possible. Yeah. I mean, very much so. And I think it's premature for the Democrats to pin all their hopes on this one person. I mean, there's elections taking place across the country. There could be plenty of viable people that get elected this fall. So let's not rush into anointing somebody as like the figurehead of the party.
Yeah.
Let's take our time.
Why aren't we combing Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan,
right.
the upper Midwest? Why aren't we saying
Connor Lamb, who won in Pennsylvania? Absolutely. I mean, great example. Well, that's the type of person
here.
You should be.
Here is
going
where
after.
This person comes, because it's the Upper Rust Belt and Florida that elect us.
Right.
Why don't we just embrace that and figure out a way to do it? I would love somebody who could actually articulate what you just said. And I loved how you said that. we have a mixed economy. There are elements of socialism and government control that are a natural part of the economy. We're not going to talk about what Finland, Norway, and Sweden does, because they're basically the size of Florida.
Yeah.
We're not going to say, well, we could just take this model, but that doesn't work.
I would love
for a Democrat to be able to articulate a message. And I'm not going to package this as socialism, but right now the government does directly interject. And you can tie that to what Trump does with his tax cuts and his regulation policy and all of that. Isn't it time somebody started injecting for you?
Government that works for you. Yeah.
That would go over very, very big.
Right. Again, it goes back, and I mentioned this before, government reform message. You package it as government reform, government that works for you, and we are going to make these types of piecemeal changes, and we're going to see what we can do to move the needle. And, you know, we know that there's pain here and there's pain there.
Yeah.
What can we do? And that's how you package it. I mean, you definitely don't use the word socialism, and you don't talk about changing the entire system, because that's not going to go anywhere.
So, I just had an idea, and I'm going to say this wrong, but you have more experience in this, so correct me after I say this. Maybe we need to form a PAC or an action committee or something called Democracy 2.0, just about that. Hey, guys, there's so many parts of the government that in the 275-year history of this country have worked good up to about, I don't know, 20 years ago when technology just tipped everything over. Maybe we need to reboot some sections of this with a whole different way of looking at things.
Right. Well, a PAC dedicated to that would be able to gain a lot more traction because they could focus on the public policy and then support candidates that in turn.
How would it be our job just walks around and speaks about stuff and collects money? What's that? I don't know what that is.
That would probably be a 501c3.
No.
Yeah. I mean,
this sounds way more complicated than it would. I want us to be like a little version of the Koch brothers.
Well, I mean, you can, for political, if you want to get involved in actually writing checks to candidates, that would be a PAC. But if what the Koch brothers do too is they have the PAC and they have the 501c3, which is just talking about the issues and education.
That's
and then they have the political side of it.
But then raising money, because as we know, all politics is money.
You do.
What about the Koch brothers and Trump coming out and taking a swipe at that? I mean, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, he's declaring war on them, basically. And I mean, I'm not surprised. I mean, they are very, very, you know, free market in their approach when it comes to tariffs and free trade. And they took it to a whole new level by, you know, directly criticizing. And the thing is, they're actually supporting some Democrats this time around. Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota.
They've basically said, we're taking the labels off if you support our issues.
Right.
And think about tariffs and the economy and immigration the way that we do. We're ready to put money behind anybody that does that.
Yeah.
That's a big sign,
isn't it? That's a huge sign, and I think it changes the perception. And they're putting Republicans on notice, saying, you know, just because we tend to align with you does not mean we are going to support you all the time.
Yeah.
But you're fair warning. And the same for the president as well. Now, they did not support the president at all, you know, when he was elected. So, you know, they made some overtures after he was elected, and now they've gone back and said, you know, no, this is who we are, and we're not doing this.
And I think, too, that there was a term somebody used called Trump triers. There's a lot of people that said, I don't like my other option for a variety of reasons. Let's just try this.
Yeah.
But those people, they've already run their course.
Oh,
they've
yeah.
already said, okay, that wasn't, I get it. I wasn't going to vote for the other option, but I'm not trying that again.
Yeah.
I think what's so interesting, and this is something that's unique to Trump, how many prominent people on his side have come out and said, I'm no longer a part of that. Not only am I no longer a part of it, I'm encouraging everybody else to actively work against it. Bill Kristol, Steve Schmidt, George Will, the Koch brothers.
So many now, yeah.
That were hardcore pillars of the conservative media, the voice of conservatism in politics, that they've come out and said, not only am I not being quiet, in some ways I'm disassociating myself with that, and in other ways I'm actively telling people to go against it. I've never seen that before.
No, that is a turning point. and we've never seen it before. And I think it's because the we're in a whole new era, and it's not just about disagreement on one or two issues. It's a feeling that our entire democratic structure is under attack. If you hear Bill Kristol and others, the terminology they use, it's about democratic norms being violated, and so they see that. And again, I think they're again putting principles and country above party, because they're seeing the long view, the big picture view, that, you know, this isn't acceptable, and we have to get back to, you know, normal checks and balances, you know, effective government, and that those practices are missing in action. They're not there.
When you hear George Will come out and say, I'm not telling you, you know, I'm not just being silent. I'm not just telling you I'm against Trump. I'm telling you, vote Democrat.
Right.
That is something I never thought would happen.
That's a shot across the bow.
That is a shot across the bow.
Completely. And I, you know, it'll be interesting to see between now and November if you see a few other kind of heavyweights do that. Yeah. Steve Schmidt, you know, who left the Republican Party.
He was John McCain's campaign manager for president.
Right.
Doesn't get too much more Republican than that.
Yeah. I mean, so again, these signals that are being sent. Now, it's interesting because you have Steve Bannon, who represents the alt-right, you know, this whole... So he came out just like a week ago and basically apparently told Trump in an op-ed that he had out, saying you need to forego white suburban women. They're gone. You're not going to get them back. They're out of the Republican coalition. Gone. They're completely gone.
That's right.
Well, and you and I have talked about the women's vote and how critical is this election. Yeah. And here you have, you know, basically de facto informal advisors to the president telling him, forget them. They're out of the coalition. You'll never be able to get them back. That's pretty telling.
That was publicly. Again, I mean, who... We don't know how they got there in the first place.
Right.
You did everything the last time around to distance them, and somehow 53% of them hung with you, but don't expect that again.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
Doesn't he look like he needs to be, I said his name wrong, doesn't Steve Bannon looks like he needs to be like washed with a pressure
washer?
He
does. So I think he's the rights version of Michael Moore, who I always thought needed to like take a shower, disheveled, ball cap, hair messy.
Like you'd like to like knock him down in your yard. You just get like the pressure washer that you use to do your fence and just blast whatever disgusting crud he has all over him off.
Yeah, he always looks like that, no matter in what context or venue.
He always looks like he could possibly be drunk or hungover or at the end of like a 3-day bender and just gaining enough of his faculties back to put a sentence together.
Well, he's striving for, you know, basically fame and acknowledgement. I mean, he definitely wants, you know, to be out there and to be in the limelight and to feel, you know, that he is making a difference. So he was thrown out of Trump's inner circle, but then he's kind of back in, weaseling his way back in. You know, so he...
But him without Breitbart, his usefulness shrinks.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't have the
megaphone to yell
that
through
that he used to have, yeah.
So let's spend our last 10 minutes. And this was an interesting topic. We were debating what our third topic should be, and we kind of hit upon this. What is the statutory of limit for being stupid anymore? And that in the last week, and this is an ongoing theme, people are losing jobs, not getting jobs, getting shamed publicly because of things they've done on social media in some ways 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
Sometimes when they were a kid, and I'm going to call 16 a kid.
Yeah.
Sometimes that they did as an adult. And then what does I was just being funny? What does that mean anymore? And does a professional comedian have a different set of rules than you or I trying to be funny?
Right. And I think, again, we have to talk about this in context. There's accountability.
No, let's not do that. Let's just take someone's tweet out of context and trying to ruin their life, Brandon.
Right. I mean,
this is 2018. We don't do context.
We don't. It's either wrong or right, one side or the other. But, you know, there's accountability when it comes to actual, like, crimes or harassment or, you know, assault that was... That's one thing and completely understandable. But if you're talking about, you know, a, you know, misaligned joke or, an ill-timed, you know, statement, something like that was made 20 years ago when somebody was, like, 23, like... does that really need to follow them the rest of their lives?
Yeah.
And there is a, I think there's a growing concern that, you know, we, I mean, not only are careers being ruined, but you have a digital footprint now that follows you everywhere.
Like, it never goes away.
It never goes away. So you are, I mean, your boss, everybody is constantly reminded of this, and it impacts you for the rest of your life. And I think sometimes we get too quick to, you know, throw people under the bus and to condemn them.
So let's pick a couple, three of these and try to unpack them. One was the pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers. This happened a couple weeks on the All-Star game.
Right.
A couple tweets came out. I think he was 16 or 17 at the time. He said he mentioned white supremacy and KKK. He didn't mention them as a joke. He said something. I don't know what the exact tweet was, but it was those two elements were there, and it was not presented as this could be taken anyway as a joke. It was the tweet was presented as his support for those that concept and that organization. He came, it got discovered. His teammates came out and supported him. He said, "That's not me. I've changed." He seemed to have gotten past that.
Right.
And I think it's because he was 16 when he did it, and the people on his team came out and said, "We don't think that's him anymore."
Right.
So does apparently age has something to do with it.
Well, it should. I mean, you don't have the maturity level at 16 as you would at 25 or 30. And I mean, a 16-year-old is a child. I mean, if somebody said something.
I have a 16-year-old, Brandon. I am really aware of how problematic being 16 is.
I mean, back when I was 16 or you were 16, I mean, you don't have the filter you have now. You just throw stuff out there. You say stuff. I mean, whatever. And you are changing. You're not mature. You don't think about things rationally. You say things that are stupid, and it's really kind of in your, you know, after you progress from about 18 to 25 that you start to solidify and your thinking and your opinions and what you actually. I mean, I'm not the same person at all as I was when I was 16.
So let me ask you this: white person makes a racially insensitive comment. Yeah. Apologize for said comment, and a standard line is that I've changed. Shouldn't they have to explain how they changed?
Yeah, and I would want to know too that, again, that this was an isolated incident. I mean, were there interactions with friends and other people that, you know, painted this picture that they really were racist? Was it kind of a one-off? Just there something we don't know? Like, what? I mean, I think it's much more of an issue if there's a character issue involved and we know that there's a history there. Or we know that there were several things. There was a pattern. But absent of a pattern, you know, and if something at 16. Now, granted, if it was something said at 25, I think it's a little different.
The statute of limitations, I was a kid, I think it runs out at like 22, 23, 24.
Yeah.
Maybe it goes on a little bit more, but I would always love to hear from somebody. This is why I used to think that way. This is what specifically happened and how it impacted me.
Right.
And this is why I don't think it anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't, most people are just trying to get through that apology and get on.
Well, and did he, again, you're heavily influenced when you're young by people around you. Did he have a mentor, you know, someone in his family, friends, somebody who instilled those views in him and he was parroting those views? Has he had life experiences now that has caused him to say, hey, I was completely wrong, that was completely unacceptable and, you know, and abhorrent views and I, you know, detest those? Like, what, that is something you would want to see and know.
So the second one we could talk about is James Gunn, director of Guardians of the Galaxy franchise. The same guy that went at Gawker, I believe, dug through his past and came up. And I think James Gunn at one point was a comedian or a comic writer or something. Came up with some tweets where he made some jokes about pedophilia and sexual assault that, one, were gross, not funny, and wholly inappropriate.
Right.
And he got fired for it. Was that the right? And these happened, I believe, 10, 12-ish years ago. So in this case, it was grown man. So you couldn't say, you know, I was 16. I'm different than that now. I was just a kid. I didn't know what I was doing. And again, I think that from a social standing, we would punish pedophilia and hurting children
more
than we would racism.
Yeah,
that's the number one.
Yeah.
So somebody who had it out for him saw that, and there was no way to defend those jokes.
Right.
If you make a joke about pedophilia, there's no, there, most people don't accept, well, I was just trying to be funny.
Right.
So,
and I think, again, as an adult and you're on Twitter, you have a responsibility because you have a audience, an expanded audience of people that are listening to you, and to put something like that out there, knowing that, hey, somebody could act upon it, somebody could be influenced by it. I mean, that's, there's just no justification for
it.
So,
Brandon, I come to you and say, here is your dream job times 10. Here's the dream amount of money you want to make times 10.
Right.
Wouldn't you hire somebody to say, I want you to do a complete 360 inventory
yeah.
of anything that can stick to me, and we're going to handle that. You can, stop me if I'm wrong, you could delete a tweet, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean, you can. Yeah, you can go back
and do that. Why are you letting those sit there for 10, unless you just think, again, maybe you think that was funny.
Right.
Maybe you think you get a comedic pass on something. Or you're just above any type of approach and any type of rules, and something like that would never stick to you.
I think part of it is feeling of invincibility. You get to a point and you don't think anything's going to hurt you because they're like, oh, I'm successful. I've done this. I've done that. I mean, surely I'm okay because, you know, I've done X, Y, and Z by now. And people
know
who I am.
I'm the Guardian of the Galaxy franchise director.
They can't fire me.
I just made like $3 billion for whatever horrible studio owns that. You're not going to touch me. The third one that I thought was interesting, and this came out today, so I'm a little bit sketchy on it. Apparently, the New York Times hired a young Asian lady, woman, so I say the term correctly, a young Asian woman, as to their editorial board. And somebody dug through her tweets, and again, there's some off-color stuff about white men in particular. There's some stuff about white privilege. As the person she's pointing those tweets at, older white guys, I'm really not outraged by that at all. And if you're being hired to offer your opinion, shouldn't
it's different.
You have
some
form
of
opinion?
She's not a hard news. I think there'd be concern if she's a hard news writer and how that could seep into her coverage, you know, of what's going on. But
they didn't hire her to write, you know, racially sensitive.
She's an opinion writer.
She's an opinion writer.
So that's I do think that is different. I think that I wouldn't be surprised if they asked her to clarify or, you know, put that in some type of context so that, you know, it doesn't become an issue that continues to attract attention.
And as an older white guy, I get it. I can see why a young Asian female would be agitated at us from time to time. I get it. You know, we occupy a lot of power positions at work. We don't get out of the way very often. You know, we hold on to power as long as we can. Sometimes we include people, sometimes we don't. So for a young Asian female who's trying to make her way up in the corporate world of journalism, fires off a tweet, which is in her mid-20s, about, damn it, white guys, stop hogging all the power and get out of my way. That seems pretty okay.
Yeah, I mean, it should have barred you from getting a job or a promotion. So I think what each of these cases shows is that you got to look at context.
Yeah.
And you can't just blanket, you know, basically bar, you know, people from being able to advance. You got to put what they did in context, look at, you know, age, all these factors, look at, you know, what was the impact, and be able to look at it that way. Because, again, there's got to be accountability, but we also got to be recognition that everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah. And everybody's stopping outraged all the time.
Yes,
there are some things you can just let go.
It seems like America doesn't want to let anything go. We want to be outraged 24/7 about everything.
That's like
under
the best
the sun.
Thing I think about being at my age. The things that outrage you really are so small anymore because you just don't.
You just don't
care. It's not about family or core things. You just don't get outraged.
Well, it gets exhausting. I mean, I can't imagine somebody who goes through and is just constantly offended and outraged all the time.
That's why I don't get my kids who are on social media all the time. You're fired up about something constantly. Doesn't that get mentally hard to carry around with you all the time?
I would think, yeah. And again, lesson here is if you're a child or an adult, but especially if you're an adult, be very careful what you put on Twitter.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, self-censor. I mean, that's out there for the world. I mean, that's permanent. You're never going to get past that.
We will end the pod this week with a public service announcement. Delete your Twitters.
Very good.
Take it easy, Brandon.
Thanks. You too, Craig.